Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Hola, mis amigos. ¿Cómo está ustedes? ¿Están ustedes? As you can tell, I'm not much of a Spanish speaker. I think I've even tried that before. Oh yeah, I did that thing about my favorite sentence in Spanish, which I won't repeat. You can go back and listen to that episode. It's like 10 or 15 ago. But I've been watching Narcos on Netflix, and it's really revitalized my love for the Espanol. Took it in high school, but I never really practiced it much. Anyway, so that's enough about me. So here we are at episode 40-freaking-7. We're only three away from the big 5-0. What's Jim gonna do for 50? What's gonna happen? Are there gonna be surprises? Maybe. But you probably shouldn't get your hopes up, because you know I don't do grand things around here. That's just not how I get down. Anyway, you should know by now that what we'll do is probably I will read a tip or a bit of writing or publishing advice or go on a rant, and then we'll read a section of the book and critique it, because that's what we do every week. So I have a little bit of a rant kind of I want to go on today. So I want to talk about luck. I listened to the Sell More Book Show with the always curmudgeon-y Jim Cuckerell. And I also read J.A. Conrath's blog, and he's a real pro indie, a real champion of indie authors. And Jim and J.A. are having a bit of a gentleman's disagreement, and I think it's kind of interesting. It's not like East Coast, West Coast beef or anything like that, but J.A. Conrath says that there is a measure of luck involved in indie success. And Mr. Jim Cuckerell doesn't agree with that, and I find that interesting. And the difference of opinion got me thinking quite a bit on how I feel about that. And I think the basic resistance. Well, let me just say up front that I basically think that Conrath is right. Sorry, Jim Cuckerell, but I think that we don't like to hear that because we don't like to think that our future is out of our hands. But let me say that I don't believe that it's 100% luck, and I don't believe that it's even 60 or 50% luck, but there is a measure of luck involved. Like, when I was in high school, I did competitive speech, and one of the things that my speech coach told me was that we can only control 50%. You can prepare your piece, and you can get in that competition round, and you can do your best performance ever. And that's only 50% of what decides whether you get first, second, or third place. You know, part of it is how well everyone else in the room does. Part of it is how the judges want to grade that particular round. So you can only control 50% of it. And in writing, in indie publishing, I think there's some measure of truth to that. So there is some luck involved. And by luck, I basically mean word of mouth. Because you can write the best possible book you can, but if it doesn't get visibility, you can write a great book, have a great cover, have a great description, have a great sales copy for your description, but if it doesn't get in front of people, it's not going to sell. And so that's where your 50% is. You write a great book, you market it well, and then you leave it up to the world. And the luck factor is whether or not it takes off, because you know, the number of books that I've sold by posting links on Facebook and Twitter, very, very few. The number of books that I've sold from my mailing list, a little more than that. The number of books that I've sold directly from blog posts, probably less than mailing list. I'm not doing this chronologically or in order of importance very well, but you get the point. The number of books I've sold from promotions that I've done through sites like Kindle Nation Daily and eReader News Today and Fussy Librarian, more than either of those things. But probably my biggest seller, the thing that makes my book sell the most, is when one person reads my book and then suggests that book to someone else. Not me suggesting that book to someone else, but someone who's read it and will vouch for the quality and say, hey, I read this book by Jim Heskett and I think you'd like it. So that's essentially where the luck is. And maybe luck isn't even the right word for it, but a book's success on word of mouth is something the author has zero control over, and that's scary. The idea of not being able to control that is frightening, and so that's why I think it's easy to resist when J.A. Conrad says there's luck involved. Because if you look at Hugh Howey's success, his blueprint for success was write a lot of books that are of good quality, put them out there, and then wait for the world to accept them. Because, you know, that's what happened to him. He wrote a bunch of books, and he'd even stopped checking his KDP dashboard, and then all of a sudden, the first short story in the Wool series took off. Just out of nowhere, he looked at his reports one day and was like, wow, what the hell is that? Wool is suddenly selling like crazy. And that's how it goes sometimes. So you may be saying to yourself, well, Jim, if it's all up to the gods, then what's the point? What's the point of studying the craft, listening to podcasts like this, busting my back to market my books and get the word out? I'll tell you this. There is still that 50% you can control. Your job is to write the best book you possibly can, write more than one, write many more than one, actually. Maybe consider having a series or several series, making the first book or books in those series free, building up a community of other writers who can support you and share your work, connecting with readers and fans one-on-one. These are all things you can control. Everything that's out of your control, you just have to let it go. You do what you can, and you let the flying spaghetti monster take care of the rest. And that's all I have to do with my rant there about luck. Ta-da! Okay. Today on the podcast, we're going to be reading Part 3, Chapter 23, a Megan chapter. And there's only two or three more chapters left in this part before we get to Part 4. But if you recall, over the last couple of chapters, we had a crescendo of action. I mean, there was no gun battles or anything like that. But we had a plot twist with Alex discovering or seeing Megan and Brian kissing. So the action is going to slow down a little here. There's sort of a valley in the action here, and I think that that's fine. It's not really, it doesn't really follow the exact scene sequel format because I had no idea what that was, and I wasn't skilled enough a writer to think and plot out scene sequel automatically like the way that experienced writers can. You know, in scene sequel, the peaks and valleys just kind of come naturally. But it is a dip in the action, and basically what we get in this chapter is some exposition, and I don't know why I keep giving you previews when I could just read it. So here we go. 23, Megan. Megan paced the parking lot of her therapist's office while talking on her cell phone to Hayden, her younger sister. Megan was wearing black slacks, heels, and a baby blue turtleneck sweater. For some reason, it just seemed appropriate to wear nice clothes to therapy. Dress for success. You're telling me you had sex with him yesterday, and today you just, poof, put him out of your mind, Hayden said. I tried to. Damn, girl, you're a little heartbreaker. Shit, Hayden, it's not like that. It's more like the spell is broken, you know? The day I talked to him for the first time at the laundromat until I slept with him, I thought about him every day, like my brain was on repeat. Then I hooked up with him, and this morning I woke up and I felt different. Okay, that's understandable. Was it a good lay? Megan rolled the ball of her foot over a stray pine cone in the parking lot. The pine cone disintegrated under the weight of her foot as she rocked it back and forth. It was okay, I guess. We were both kind of drunk. How about some details, Hayden said. I'm not in the mood for that. It happened, and now I feel like shit. If Chris finds out, I'm dead. That's all I want to say about it. Help me understand how it went down. Did he totally put the moves on you? Geez, Hayden, you're so damn persistent, Megan said. Actually, more like I put the moves on him. I got a couple beers in me and I got bold. You got smashed and took advantage of this poor guy. I guess I'd totally do the same thing if he was cute enough. Or he doesn't have to be all that cute if I drink enough Goldschlager. Megan had thought she had possibly intimidated him because she came on too strong. Brian acted shy and unwilling at first, but when they were in his room and the clothes were off, the rest progressed as expected, awkward, exciting, over too quickly. What happened afterwards? Were you like, okay, thanks, I gots to go, Hayden said. No, Hades, it isn't like that. We talked for a while, then I went down and said goodbye to him in my car and went home and went to bed. He wanted me to stay, but I just sleep better in my bed. Anyway, this morning I made breakfast and then I went for a run. By the time I finished my run, it was just like I was ready to move on. Clay on the basketball court? That had been a judgment mistake, but this was serious. She had broken her marriage vow, which carried legal ramifications along with it. The more she pondered that fact, the more the aching of guilt turned into throbbing. We made plans for lunch today, but I didn't show up. That's not like you, Hayden said. True, maybe I was a chicken shit not to show up and not call. But I spent half the morning crying. How was I supposed to show up to a date with this guy and pretend that everything's normal? I didn't even know what I was supposed to say. She considered the possibility that he might view her as a conquest. The thrill of the chase would be over, and he would return to his normal life. Guys could be like that. However, the more she thought about that, the less likely it seemed. He was too damn unassuming to be that kind of person. I'm not sure what to tell you, Mags. I don't really see what the big deal is. I mean, your husband doesn't own you. You had a little fun, so what? I know you'll figure it out, though. You always seem to find your way out of these things. Just spend some time with it. You'll be fine. Had a little fun, so what? Megan looked through the glass door into the lobby, and she could see that Dr. Foster's door had opened. Time to go in. Maybe you're right. Thanks, sis, Megan said. I'm at my therapist's office. I need to go. I think she's ready for me. I love you, Megs. Call me if you need anything. You too, sis. I'll be okay. She rehearsed what she thought Dr. Foster would say as she entered the building, and what she would say in return, and tried to weigh if the cost of unburdening her soul would be worth the potential judgment she might receive. I don't have to tell her everything, do I? Therapy is my time, it's my growth, and I should be able to go at my own pace and reveal whatever I want. Megan took a seat outside the office and thought about her last session, in which she had blurted out a stream of anxious ramblings about Wilde and the pistol she witnessed him holding the day of the laundry run-in with Brian, and about her visit from Walker back in January. She had told no one else this information. Megan had been careful not to give Dr. Foster specific details about any crime or potential criminal act, which Megan knew would compel the doctor to alert the police. No one should feel unsafe in their own home, was all Dr. Foster had to say about it. The easy way out would be to call the phone number on the card in the locked box underneath her bed, tell Walker what she had seen, and send Wiles to prison. Then, the house would be hers, and maybe Walker would fulfill her promise and bring Chris home. But along the way, there would be hearings, arraignments, jury trials, testimony rehearsals, sentencing, and perhaps more. Would there be witness protection? How far up the ladder is Derek? For all she knew, her roommate was some big-time crime lord, and sending him to prison would put her in the position that if she somehow endured the process, her reward might be that she and Chris had to live in a new town with new names, unable to contact their family and friends. And Chris, how would he react to her sending his brother to prison? Would he support her, or would he resent her and grow bitter at her betrayal of the family? She had no way of knowing. Can I build a life with a man if I've snitched on his brother to the federal government? If he finds out about the cheating, will he even want to build a life with me? Mrs. Wiles, the receptionist said. When Megan looked at her, the receptionist motioned toward the open door of Dr. Foster's office. Megan collected her purse and quietly entered the room. All right, that's all of the reading. Now let's go back and critique some stuff. First off, there were three things that came to mind as I was reading through this. The first of those being, there are an awful lot of really bad dialogue tag choices in here, and I'll point out some of those as we go along, but if you were listening or if you were reading along at indieauthoranswers.com, you probably noticed a lot of those bad dialogue tags. Second, this chapter completely missed the boat on where the conflict should be, because the first half of this chapter is basically complete exposition. It's just Megan talking to her sister Hayden on the phone. And then the second half of the chapter is a bunch of summary, kind of a flashbacky exposition summary, referring to when she was in therapy before. And, you know, it seems like that's where the conflict would be. It would have been much better conflict for Megan to be in therapy with her therapist talking, and the therapist is trying to pry something out of Megan that Megan doesn't want to say. There's conflict inherent in that. Instead, the bulk of this chapter focuses on something completely not conflicty at all. It reminds me of a writing group that I used to belong to, and a writer brought a chapter from her book, and she was a good writer, and her book was interesting, but there was one chapter where she missed the boat on conflict completely, because the chapter was all about this woman sitting on the beach, and I don't even remember. It's like she's sitting on the beach, and then someone comes up, and they have a conversation, and then the chapter's over, and there were references in this chapter to her being stalked right before this happened, about how some guy was following her on the beach, and then it, like, the guy went away or something. But that was two sentences of a summary in a chapter that was like 1500 words, and I was like, that's where your conflict is. You know, you completely skimmed over the most interesting thing that happened in the chapter. Anyway, so the third thing, oh wait, that is three things, right? The first was the bad dialogue tags. The second was how this chapter didn't focus on conflict. And no, wait, okay. You guys are seeing the inside of my brain right now. The third thing was that the first part of this chapter is all about her and Brian. And then the second part of the chapter is basically summing up Megan's arc so far. And now this is a problem with the fact. Now, here's why this is a problem. One, because this book has too many POV characters and too many subplots that don't directly relate to each other or don't appear to relate to each other. Because Megan's total POV word count for the whole book is maybe something like 8 or 10,000 words, it's so long in between her POV chapters, I have to devote too much time recapping everything that's going on with Megan. So it's like every time we see Megan, we have to be reminded, oh, this is a problem for her, this is her other problem, because there's no way the reader's going to remember. So we waste a lot of word count just doing a recap. And that could be fixed by probably taking those subplots out, because even though, like, the Walker subplot is going to loosely tie in to Brian and Alex's story later on, and the Chris subplot does kind of tie in, it's not tied in enough that a reader would be clued in to everything that's going on without having to do these unnecessary seeming recaps. So now let's go back and hit on some highlights. So first of all, the reason this chapter exists at all is because I was intending for this book to be part of a series, and not a series in the traditional sense, but I had this idea for a world of books that were standalone stories that featured certain characters. And so the next book in the series would be 10 years later, because this book takes place in 2003, remember, it was going to be 10 years later, and one of the main characters was going to be Hayden. Now, if you have, well, you haven't because it doesn't come out till December, but my book Airbag Scars was originally that sequel, and there is a character named Hayden in that book. Now, the version of Airbag Scars that I'm publishing in December 2015 is very different from the original book that I'd intended. It has a complete different plot. It has Hayden's different. All of the other characters are different. It's actually the first book in my Micah Reed series, but the idea of Hayden is the same. But I basically, the only reason she's in it is because I really like the name. I like Hayden as a name because it's it means heathen. And so Hayden is this kind of disillusioned person who her life gets worse as the book goes on. And anyway, so I'll skip that. But the point of this chapter says it's supposed to be glue. And later on in the epilogue for this book, there are some things that try to tie it in later to Airbag that didn't make it into the new version of Airbag. Anyway, So Megan is standing in front of her therapist's office. Now, this could have been interesting if we demonstrated that maybe because she's standing outside her therapist's office talking on the phone, and I think we get the impression that she doesn't really want to go in, but it might have been good tension if maybe she was already late for her appointment, but she's standing outside and she's dreading going in, and maybe as she's talking to her sister, she keeps looking inside and seeing the therapist who knows she's late, and the therapist's like, are you coming in or not? And Megan doesn't know what to do. That might provide some tension if it was mixed in throughout this dialogue. So right off in the first line of this chapter, we get good grounding of where we are, even though the sentence is very clunky. Megan paced the parking lot of her therapist's office while talking on the cell phone to Hayden, her younger sister. Now, we could have the main awkward thing there is those last four words, Hayden, comma, her younger sister. We could have just said talking on the cell phone to Hayden, and then the reader would have picked up on the dialogue, or could have said talking on the cell phone to her younger sister, and then the reader would have figured out pretty soon that this person she was talking to was also named Hayden. The first really awkward, the first bad dialogue tag is, you're telling me, comma, you had sex with him yesterday, comma, and today, comma, you just dot, 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 poof, comma, put him out of your mind, comma, Hayden said. Now, here's why this is bad. And I do this a lot in this book, and I probably mentioned this before, but newer listeners, maybe you would benefit from this. So when you're writing a line of dialogue and you're going to put in dialogue attribution, you should put that dialogue attribution as close to the beginning of the sentence as possible. Like, the correct way to do this would have been, you're telling me, comma, Hayden said, you had sex with them yesterday? Because there's so many commas in here, it's going to take the reader like 3 full seconds to get all the way through this sentence. And by the time they get to the dialogue attribution at the end, the reader may have already been convinced that it was Megan who was saying this and not Hayden. Because this is on a new paragraph and there's nothing to indicate, there's no action beat at the beginning of this paragraph to indicate that it's Hayden or Megan speaking. You know, we don't know. So that's just it seems like a little nitpicky thing, but it's the kind of thing that can pull a reader out of a story. And one thing you might notice as we're going along is Hayden is even, if this was even possible, Hayden seems more sexual than her sister, Megan, because Hayden's like, was he a good lay? Damn, girl, you're a heartbreaker. All that. How about some details? All that kind of stuff. And Megan is over-sexualized, and Hayden is even really over-sexualized. Now, if any of people out there have read my novel Reagan's Ashes, I put in an inside joke. Here's some real inner circle Jim Heskett stuff. I included an inside joke in that book that was mainly an inside joke just for me, where Reagan is reading her boyfriend Spoon's favorite paperback, and Reagan doesn't like the book because all the female characters are either, she says, they're either outlandishly warlike or outlandishly sexual. And that was my critique of my own earlier writing, just to amuse myself. I put in inside jokes like that in a lot of my work, just to amuse myself. Anyway, you didn't need to know that, but I enjoyed telling you. So let's go on. So we learn from this chapter, the point that we're trying to get across here is basically Megan feels bad about sleeping with Brian. Because in Here I Am, what I'm trying to do with that is I'm trying to salvage Megan's relatability, because she's not a likable character. She's not very relatable. I mean, she is going to get a little more likable because some really bad shit happens to her that she doesn't deserve later on. But at this point, you know, that you can have a character, and this is kind of a broad general statement that doesn't always apply, but in general, you can have a character do bad things as long as they feel bad about it and the reader buys that they feel bad about it. Because a character with no conscience is a villain. And even villains have consciences. You know, maybe stereotypical villains don't have any, but even your villain has to have a little bit of conscience, you know, or your villain has to have strong motives. But if you're a good guy, does bad things, and has no conscience about it, then your readers will not like him or her. There's just no way. So this is what I'm trying to do in this chapter, at least, demonstrate that Megan feels bad about breaking her marriage vow. Anyway, so we know that Megan is basically over Brian. So this is the answer to the last chapter of when Brian went to go meet her for brunch and she didn't show up. This is the answer to that, that Hayden or Megan was like, the spell is broken. She slept with him and now she knows it's bad, and so she stood him up for lunch. So we do get one little line of action beat here where Megan rolls her foot over a stray pinecone in the parking lot and then the pinecone disintegrated under the weight of her foot. I think probably what I was trying to do there was to be deep and to demonstrate how Megan was destroying something beautiful or destroying something good. But at least it does help ground the reader, because otherwise this chapter threatens to get into white room territory. White room is a, I think that's what it's called, it's a literary term where it's just basically two characters talking and there's no action beats or description. I think that's what you call that, white room. Anyway, look it up and send me an email at indieauthoranswers@gmail.com if I'm wrong. Anyway, so they're still talking about it, and Megan's like, if Chris finds out I'm dead. Megan tries to kid herself into believing that Brian may look at it as a conquest, even though she knows that that's probably not true. Then there's a reference to Clay on the basketball court. Now, recalling something that happened 100 pages ago in the book usually wouldn't work, but I think in this case it probably does work. I mean, Clay isn't really that memorable a name. If it was Beelzebub, I'm sure the reader would go, oh yeah, Beelzebub, that frat boy she made out with. But the fact that it mentions the basketball court, and that's the only time in the book that a basketball court has been referenced, probably is a good enough anchor to remind the reader of where, what that is, Clay on the basketball court. That'd have been a judgment mistake, and the reader would probably go, oh yeah, that's when Megan made out with that frat guy, and the reader may or may not remember that Wiles showed up and basically broke it up before anything could happen. So then Megan gets off the phone, and we have this big polar shift to the chapter being about something completely different. And you couldn't tell this if you were just listening, but there's no scene break here. This chapter probably could have benefited from a scene break if I was going to keep it in the current format. I mean, what I'm saying is if I rewrote this chapter, I wouldn't include it, or I would completely change it so that Megan was in therapy, like I talked about before, having that conflict of she doesn't want to tell the doctor some things, the doctor's trying to draw them out of her. But if I were keeping this chapter in the current format, I would at least put a scene break in between the conversation with her sister and the reflection about everything else that's bothering Megan, because it's like a completely different topic. And so a scene break would help get that across to the reader. Why don't I keep saying scene break a few more times? We get the reminder about Walker, the reminder about Wiles wielding a pistol and talking about Brian the day she met him. And then it just kind of goes on and on. It's just a whole lot of summary about everything and Megan's interferes. This is kind of sequel, but this is sequel that should have happened. Okay, in the chapter where Megan saw Wiles talking on the phone to some mysterious person and Wiles pulled out the gun and was like, I'm going to take care of it, you know, Megan freaked out. That was like a good conclusion to a scene, a good cliffhanger. Then this is basically the sequel to that, because she's like, you know, Wiles is wielding a gun, things are getting dangerous, I should go turn him in, because that's in the scene sequel format, that's the dilemma part. Like, I've got this problem, I don't know what to do, I don't know what the next step I should take, here's my dilemma. And then you come up with an action, and then that leads you into the next scene. But because we've seen Megan several times since then, it doesn't really, chronologically, it doesn't make sense why she would be considering all this now. Anyway, and part of her dilemma is, you know, she wants to turn in Derek because she wants her house back and she's afraid of Derek, but her husband is Derek's brother, so that's an interesting wrinkle in it. You know, this is actually a good dilemma because Megan has been, you know, approached by the feds. She needs to turn in Derek. She doesn't know how it's going to affect her. She doesn't know how it's going to affect her marriage. So in terms of a dilemma, Megan is in a really juicy spot because she has no idea what to do next. And that is a good place to put your character when seemingly all the odds are against them and they don't know what to do to get themselves out of the situation. Now, I can tell you Megan isn't going to come up with a great plan. It's just going to kind of stumble in her lap, so there's a little bit of a spoiler. But the chapter ends then with Megan going into her therapist's office, which isn't really a great way to end the chapter because we're not sitting there wondering what's Megan going to tell her therapist. If we'd established that, you know, if Megan had established really well through her inner monologue, I don't know what to tell the therapist when I go in there. What can I say? I'm freaking out. Then ending the chapter when she was about to walk in there would have been pretty interesting. But as it stands, it's just kind of boring and doesn't really end. And as a reader, you're looking through this, you're like, when can I get back to the POVs of the characters that I actually am interested in? You know, which is probably Wiles or Alex, because they're really the only interesting, or Miguel, basically anyone but Brian and Megan. And it's unfortunate that the main character and one of the other main characters in this book are so such limp socks. But anyway, we're not reading through this book because it's great literature. We're reading through this book to tear it apart and learn some things about it. And that's all I have to say this week. Thanks for listening, guys. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you soon.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad, we will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.